I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Property assessments in Jackson County have historically been low, but if you're a home or a business owner, this year you might be looking at a big increase, and that is causing an uproar. Today, how the county legislature and its constituents feel about the spike. We'll ask the assessor about her methodology and find out how and if the county executive's office plans to fix an assessment process that has thousands contesting their future tax bills. Then, from mace to martial arts, women are finding ways to take safety into their own hands. For some, that means carrying a gun. We'll talk with two women who are taking different approaches to protecting themselves. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Jackson County legislators are so fed up with the biennial real estate reassessment process that they've asked County Executive Frank White to discard all the numbers and start all over again. That may sound good to a lot of residents who have seen their assessments shoot skyward in a big way. But White is saying that he can't stop a process that is governed by state law. His hands are tied. He says he's not going to put himself in the position of breaking the law. It's a mess. It's more than just a little bit chaotic, and homeowners and business owners are looking at big increases to their property tax bills in the meantime. With us to talk about all this are the leaders of Jackson County Legislature. That's Teresa Galvin. She's the chairwoman. Teresa, nice to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Dan Tarwater is the vice chair. Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Gail McCann Beatty is here. She's the county director of assessment. Gail, good morning.
Good morning.
Also here is Caleb Clifford. He's chief of staff to county executive Frank White. Caleb, welcome to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Teresa, is this the big mess that it looks like it is?
I don't think it has to be. I think we could work together and come to a resolution.
Dan, but it sure looks like it's a mess to a lot of regular folks out there.
There seems to be some inconsistencies amongst the values, and right now what we're doing as a legislative body is just asking them to please look at this, because we are hurting a number of businesses and a number of people with their home values. And I think, you know, if we give maybe more time so people can appeal, I believe the state is there are laws that are able to do that, and we need to look at all options.
You know, Teresa, all nine members of the county legislature signed a letter last week asking the county executive, Frank White, to throw out the results of this year's reassessment and start all over again. Why did lawmakers decide to go that way? And what's the point? What are they trying to achieve here?
Well, just to be clear, it wasn't an I got you or an attempt to embarrass the executive, as was stated. We just needed to get somewhere to get off dead center. I've spoken with him, and he has said, you know, according to state statutes, he can't do anything. And I feel that he believes that, and he doesn't want to break the law. However, I believe there's something more that we can do.
Such as?
I think we should put a cap on the residential. Say we put a 10% cap on residential, 20% on commercial, and then go back and look at the future and see where we're at and what everybody needs to be at.
Does the legislature have that authority?
I don't know.
Caleb Clifford, what about this idea of just putting caps on and moving forward from there?
Steve, I appreciate the sentiment and the desire to ensure that there aren't significant increases, but that example right there is exactly where the difference is. There is no authority to do so, and in fact, that would be violating the law. Gail, by state statute, is required to set these values at fair market value, and that's it. There is nothing that gives her the authority to just falsely cap something because of a political desire.
Gail, weigh in here as director of assessment here. Caleb just said the law says you've got to set these values at market rate. Well, apparently that hasn't been done in a really long time. Why not?
That's a question I don't know that I can answer. I know that when I took the job, I made the commitment that we would seek to reach market value. But I think that the distinction that we need to make here is that just because we have reached market value and there have been significant increases in market value does not mean that there has to be significant increases in your taxes.
That's because the legislature can lower mill levies to avoid just what you're talking about.
The legislature for the county, but all of our different taxing jurisdictions. We are a state where the levies are based off of budgets. So ideally, in a perfect world, if your market value went up 1,000%, they would then lower the levy and you wouldn't have any change at all in your tax. However, we also know that the taxing jurisdictions may have some increases in their budget, and therefore they may, most of them, we're still seeing them lowering their levies. This is just an estimate at this point. It is not the final numbers. We certify our values 3 different times throughout the year, and they won't make that final determination until we certify in the fall,
right,
after all of the BOE. So just because there is an increase in market value does not necessarily mean there has to be an increase in your taxes.
You know, Dan Tarwater, you've been on the legislature for a long time. Why hasn't the assessor been setting these values at market rates up to now? Because it seems like the issue here is that so many values went up so dramatically, that's the shock value that's rippling across Jackson County. Maybe a more gradual increases would have staved off this kind of revolt.
Steve, I believe you're 100% correct. You know, in the past, there have been increases. You know, and then there's physical inspections and other things that go along with that. In 2013, there was a big mess at that point. Our assessor did lose their job. And then they went back and reevaluated about 60,000 properties. But they also were able to get those things out to the people so that they could go to the different entities to appeal. A lot of, you know, at the informal appeals, people had about a week. And now they have, you know, a short time, July 8th, I believe, with the BOE. So I would ask that we move that back a little bit.
Let's go back to my question. Why weren't these market rates set at value years ago? Why is Gail McCann-Beatty having to do this in one fell swoop, setting off all this angst across Jackson County, Missouri?
I would say that a lot of them were set at the rate. They're, even today, there are a lot of them that still aren't set at a market rate. You know, we've seen different reports on some of the properties that are valued at $125,000 and then people bought them for $1 million. Those are still wrong. So I believe that we've done a good job of trying to get them to those points. But right now, we also have a number of them that are artificially high.
Clifford, weigh in here. Caleb, I'm sorry.
No, absolutely. Yeah. If I could, I think Legislator Tarwater is absolutely correct. There are properties and there have been properties that are set at market rate, but that is almost more of a reason why we need to make sure that it's across the board, because if they're not set at market rate, this is about burden shifting. This isn't about the amount of taxes. So an example would be the east side of Kansas City in 2018 was at 103% of the average sale value. Ward Parkway was at 75%. What that means is that the east side of Kansas City was subsidizing the people who were living on Ward Parkway, and that is exactly what we have to get away from. This is not about whether or not the pie gets bigger. This is about what piece of that pie you're responsible for. Mm-hmm. And when we have inequities like that, and let's be very clear and very candid on this, those inequities always seem to go a certain way, whether it's here, whether it's in Cook County, whether it's in other parts of the country, those inequities are always to the disfavor of those that lower the working class families, and we've got to stop that. And if I could, to your question to Legislator Tarwater, the answer to the question I think was answered by Crystal Williams, one of their colleagues in the legislature at a recent meeting. She said, and I believe accurately so, the Jackson County has not had the political courage or political will to get this done, and I think that we've got to commend and support Gail in doing so.
Is that a fair point, Teresa Galvin?
What I was going to say is I think most of us know that a lot of these properties have been under market value for a long time. And whether it's the action or inaction of previous administrations, you know, I don't know what was happening because I wasn't here and, you know, Frank White wasn't here either. I will say, can I read something that Ed Stoll, who's our chief administrative officer, is that his title now, read to us on October 23rd.
How long is it?
It's just like 2 sentences.
Yes,
I'm not going to read this whole thing. So he said, beginning with the 2015 assessment cycle, in consultation with Ebert & Associates, the county instituted new assessment procedures, including procedures for implementation of a full equalized plan as an incremental advancement of accurate equitable valuations through the 2017, 2019, 2021 reassessment cycles.
That means what?
That meant it was going to take four cycles, and in four cycles, we would get us up to market value. Mm-hmm. Instead, we just, 2019, here we are, we're at market value. And I think had everybody moved up gradually, then it would have been a lot easier on them than, you know, sticker shock, here you're at market value now.
Gail McCann-Beatty, why not do it gradually? Why do it all in one fell swoop that's, again, causing so much angst?
Well, unfortunately, the statute doesn't give me that option. It simply says we have to reach market value.
In a sense, you're a victim of your predecessors in the assessment office then.
I am. And let me give you an example that I ran across. A property that sold in 2012 for $92,000. After whatever happened in 2013, that was reduced to $38,000. We are now, that same property I have now on for $90,000. I'm still a little low.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can imagine, I absolutely understand the sticker shock that the taxpayers are going through.
Mm-hmm.
But if we don't get this right, disproportionately, our poor communities are covering the cost for others. We've had the same exact issue between residential and commercial. And the only true equity is when everyone is paying their fair share based off of their market value.
Mm-hmm. So given what Caleb Clifford said a few minutes ago about the East Side subsidizing other parts of town, the Ward Parkway corridor being one of them, are you able to adjust that in this latest round of assessment adjustments as you go through your job?
I think if you really look at the East Side, you're going to see in some cases we've had some properties that have gone down too, but no one hears about those that have gone down. The only people screaming are those that have gone up. And so it's a balance between the two. Areas where maybe property values have fallen, then their values went down. But unfortunately, those that go to media are only those who saw the large increases. And that's not really fair. And that's actually a much smaller portion mm-hmm. of taxpayers that were affected in that manner.
You know, Dan Tarwater, is it possible to join with the other taxing jurisdictions, the library, the school districts, and say, we are going to adjust the levies going forward so that taxes are not increased on anybody to avoid some of this controversy that's going on right now?
Yes, and most of the jurisdictions have a rollback provision. Kansas City School District, where a lot of the values did change, they do not. So they do not have to roll back, whereas other districts
do. But they could roll back.
They could.
Okay.
But I would love it if they did.
I was going to say, is there a political path forward for you to join and link arms with the other taxing jurisdictions and say, we are not going to raise your taxes this year, even though your values have gone up, because we're going to lower the other factor here, which are these mill levies that are part of the process?
A lot of the levies will come before the legislature, and yes, we will look at rolling those back. I do not agree that the East Side is providing benefits for the people on Ward Parkway. So I believe that argument is fundamentally flawed.
Why?
Because if you look at the amount of tax that people are paying, the increase that happened along the Ward Parkway area, you had values on homes that went from $280,000 to $580,000. And in a certain 3-4 block area, I wasn't able to even pull up anybody that had sold for anywhere in that area. So I think we're adjusting those now, and it was a flaw in the system. But I also had someone that gets at the estimated tax bill, and Gail had said before that has contemplated some of the rollback already.
Mm-hmm.
So I had one person out in Martin City where their tax base changed by their tax value by $60,000. Gail went in and was able to make that change. But what if they didn't call?
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden they just get their bill and then they move to Johnson County.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to KCUR's Up to Date, and we're talking this morning about the reassessment process in Jackson County that's caused so much angst across Jackson County. If you have a question, our number 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. You know, Gail McCann-Beatty, one of the big concerns that I've heard expressed is this idea that it's unclear to residents what methods you've used to assess these properties. Can you describe what that process is? How arbitrary is it? What's it based on? Give us a sense.
So it's not arbitrary. There are two different forms of appraisal. There's mass appraisal and fee appraisal, and I'm going to try to make this simple, but it does get a little complicated. Most people do a refinance or something like that, they get a 20-25 page report, and there's three comps that compare their home to. We have 300,000 parcels in our county. Mass appraisal is the system which we use for assessing. We are no different than any other county, any other in the country, in the world. There is actually an international group. So what does mass appraisal mean? Mass appraisal means we've divided our city up into approximately 68 neighborhoods, not neighborhoods as most people would think of them, but it's really a grouping of neighborhoods. And then it is using a computer to help us make those adjustments based off of, we pull in all the sales in those areas. And then we adjust it by factors, whether it be for differences in the number of bedrooms or square footage or condition. But it's a computer that helps us do this because you cannot physically do it individually on 300,000 parcels. I have had someone ask, how can you have three houses in a row, same square footage, but have different values? It's very simple. We also monitor permits through the city. So on one property, I've got a lot of permits where we've seen updates on it. We also know that everybody doesn't necessarily go get a permit when they do work on their house. So the next house may only have one permit on it, but the third one may have none. So ultimately in our system, that property is, one is at fair condition, one is at average condition, and one is at good condition. On the outside, they all look like they are equal. But from our records, they are not necessarily equal. Now, that property owner, the reason why we have appeals, and that is part of reassessment, it is not a result of, but a part of, is so that that taxpayer has the opportunity to weigh in and say, oh, these are just alike.
I was going to say, I'm looking for the number in front of me here. I think you had something like 21,000 folks file informal appeals in the last couple of weeks. How on earth are you going to be able to navigate through 21,000 appeals?
So what we are doing, we are grouping them into our neighborhoods so that you can look at them as a whole. That will help us get through them a little bit faster. We are working in an enormous amount of overtime. But the system is designed to get through them. If you go over to St. Louis County, they are anticipating well over 24,000.
So this isn't unusual, at least one sense.
This is a large number for us, but there are other counties that are dealing. St. Louis County had 24,000 in 17, and their values went up this year 15%. And so they are estimating a much larger. In fact, one of their BOE members resigned because of the anticipated volume. My opinion is it's not about the volume. It's about helping each and every taxpayer that feels like we may have gotten their value incorrect.
You know, the other thing I've noticed in just reading the stories about this situation is that your department is understaffed. Is that true?
We need more. We absolutely need more.
How big are you? How many more do you need?
I could easily triple my staff based on the number of parcels that we have in our county.
Triple your staff.
Yes.
And the fact you're understaffed, what impact is that having on this entire process?
Well, it's having a significant. That's why we're putting in, I am well over my overtime budget. Right now, we're only halfway through the year. My staff, I have to give them kudos because they are working 2 to 4 hours overtime during the week, and they're working Saturdays and Sundays.
Wow. Teresa Galvin, you are the chairwoman of the Jackson County Legislature right now. You just heard your assessor say she's way understaffed. Can you guys get her some help?
She and I were just having that conversation before we came in here, and we were going to talk more about where she's at, what she needs, and budget time's coming up, so we are looking at that. I will say we also had Ebert and Associates, who's an outside consultant that was my understanding was in helping with the assessment department.
Dan?
We have, throughout the years, we have paid Ebert and Associates about about $1.4 million.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, we've also suggested, and it's before Gail got there, and Gail, I do have to give you credit. You've been wonderful, and your department is doing great because this isn't, you know, something that you created. Ebert and Associates was supposed to be coming in here and helping. Every time that Gail has asked for people or the administration has asked to help, you know, with their assessment department, we've given them what they need to the tune of the $1.4 million with Ebert and Associates. We have also suggested look at the pay ranges in there, and instead of paying this outside firm that doesn't have anything to do with Jackson County, let's start paying people that work for Jackson County, that live in Jackson County, that will work for Gail, and raise those salaries and get her more people.
Just quickly, Gail, I need to go to some phone calls here.
Okay. So really quickly, Ebert and Associates has been working with us, and quite frankly, we would have never gotten this far without them. But if you look at the number of staff that we need, the money that he has been paid is a drop in the bucket of what needs to be really put into this to have enough staff to do the job the way it needs to be done.
You know, one issue here is that Jackson County assesses every couple of years. Johnson County on the Kansas side does it every year and seems to have something that is closer to a model system here. Caleb, is that the way to go? Is that the future here?
I think the state of Missouri needs to look at that as an option. Now, obviously, we're governed by state statute, but if it was every year, it would allow us an opportunity to make it up the next year if we have a mistake. But we have to wait 2 years, and the market has changed dramatically, and it requires a great deal of work. To the point of the funding, if I could just very quickly, the state of Missouri reduced the funding for all counties in the state of Missouri to do this very, very difficult work years ago. And the county and the legislature has made up a big gap there. But I will say that I believe it's a false choice between staffing and bringing in outside experts. We need both. And quite frankly, the only reason we're in the position we are today is because the legislature voted for and supported the contract for John Ebert and others and the funding. But we've got to do better.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Kip from Kansas City, Missouri. Kip, you're on the air.
Hi, I'll try to be calm and concise. I have a building that's our business housed in, and it's constantly almost on the dangerous buildings because it's a large structure and needs lots of repairs. My assessment value went up from $50,000 to $288,000 on a building that has almost no amenities to it at all. The thing that concerns me most isn't just the fact that it'll drive me out of the neighborhood and take my businesses and employees with it to Kansas. It's also most of the blocks I'm in are a lot of poor people, a lot of elderly Hispanic who do not speak the language. There's block after block of disenfranchised people who don't listen to NPR, have no idea what's going on, and are going to be hit with these incredible taxes that will result in foreclosure and driving them out of the neighborhood. It looks from our end as if it's being done to make way for developers who are given free land. That's the talk in the neighborhoods, I'm just telling you. So thank you very much. I appreciate the segment.
Yeah, Kip, I appreciate that. Dan, what would you say to Kip?
I'm sorry. But once again, the legislature, we're trying to do everything humanly possible. And, you know, this is from the administration's point of view. It's in their hands. And that's why we're asking, give us a little more time. Give the people more time. Find out a way to solve this. We agree with Kip.
You know, but the problem is we're hearing that the state law says you can't go against state law, Dan. That Frank White's hands are tied. So what is the path forward given that?
The path forward is to appeal to the state and find out if we can get some more time. And I believe
in
the past we've done that.
Is that a possibility?
No, it's not a possibility. It's in state statute when we have to move forward on this. That being said, though, Gail and her team are working with everyone who's filed an informal appeal and will continue to work with them throughout the process in the next couple of months. And if they find that there's been an error, they will make that correction or ask the Board of Equalization to make that correction.
You know, Gail McCann-Betty, the other comment that Kit made was that folks who don't speak English might be at a disadvantage here. The forms, as I understand it, are only provided in English, not in Spanish. How are those folks going to be able to navigate this system?
So we have, I have made myself available to community groups as much as I can physically do. We do have folks in the office that speak Spanish. So if anyone had called in and there was a language barrier, we would absolutely deal with that. It is not my intent to disenfranchise anybody. It is not my intention to push anybody out of any community. I grew up in this city. I was born and raised here. I've had options to move away from Kansas City and didn't. I overbuilt in a neighborhood to live in the city, to continue to live in this city. That is absolutely not my intent at all.
But folks who don't speak English might be at a disadvantage here. They're going to need some help.
And we will absolutely, I am willing to work with those communities and figure out what else we may need to do to give them some help.
I was going to say, Caleb, what else needs to happen to get the word out so that folks who might be at a disadvantage here can get the help they might need to navigate a confusing system?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the main reasons that Gail and I are here today, is to make sure that we can take every opportunity that we can to make people aware of what's going on. And I think that the number of informal appeals is in part a testament to how that messaging is getting out. And I've got to commend Gail for attending community meetings, meetings established by members of the legislature, and working with these communities. And as she said, we have people who are Spanish-speaking, but we're also working on making everything that we have available in both English and Spanish as we move forward.
Okay, back to some calls. Gary from Kansas City, Missouri. Gary, you're on the air.
Okay, first off, I'm sick, but let me tell you, I got the data from the government sources and from sales, and I'm on the 1,100 block of Romney. And I compared the 1,200 block of Romney. On the 1,200 block of Romney, the houses sold for about $450,000 to $500,000. They were valued by the county $184,000 under those selling prices. My block, where houses were sold for less, were valued by the county $148,000 above selling price. How can you do this?
Why would the properties be evaluated above selling prices, Gail?
So what I can assume is that that may be a situation where we have, he said it was a two-block difference, but they fall within the same neighborhood grouping, and that may be a situation that we need to separate them out. That is something that we can certainly look at.
He should appeal.
He should absolutely appeal.
And if folks who have missed the first deadline, there's still a chance to appeal in a more formal way in
absolutely.
The days to come, right?
And so they still have until July 8th to file the appeal with the BOE. But I also want to say to those people who have already filed their informal review, we are going to continue to process those, whether they file a formal BOE appeal or not, we will continue to process.
What's the difference between an informal appeal and a formal appeal?
So informal appeals are not statutorily driven. This was something that we did to try to help the taxpayers. Some people are intimidated about appearing before a board. So this was a way that we could address taxpayers' issues and try to resolve them without them having to go through the board.
Okay, but the more formal process, that deadline is still out there. People can still go ahead and file an appeal.
Absolutely.
Okay, let me grab some more calls here. Mary from Beacon Hill in Kansas City, Missouri. Mary, good morning.
Hi, Steve. Good to talk with you.
You bet.
My question of Gail is, asking her if she would be willing to meet one-on-one with me on behalf of my community. We do not think that the model created reassessments that really do reflect fair market value. And here's the two examples I would share, but I can go deeper face-to-face. Number one, I assessed all the sales that occurred of older homes in Beacon Hill over the last 2 years. There were 27 of them. 89% of them are assessed way too low, so the county is leaving money on the table. And then, Dale, I'm going to be one of the few examples. I live in a new home in Beacon Hill. My assessment went down from the accurate number to half of what it should be, And I am one of the rare individuals who filed an appeal saying you assessed me way too low. Would you meet with me?
I would absolutely meet with you. And again, this is one of the challenges that we have where we have neighborhoods with new construction. But I also would point out that much of the new construction in Beacon Hills is abated and you are only paying on your land value right now. So we've had questions, but I also have concerned people in Beacon Hills because they do live in the older sections and the impact that the newer homes are having on them. And it's we are looking at that, and I would absolutely meet with you.
Okay, the path forward here as we leave this conversation. Caleb, where are we going? You're saying your hands are tied. You got to proceed. The legislature wants you to put a cap on. You're saying that can't happen. What's the path forward in your view?
The path forward is to continue communicating, especially between our assessment department and those that have concerns. They're going to continue to work overtime and through the night and work on each and every one of these properties, but take advantage of the opportunities that you have. Now that the BOE process has started, we encourage people to go through that process if they believe that their house is above market value. But in the end, I want to make this note. This is about fairness and equity. And there are many, many people in this community, often homeowners, who have been paying at market value. And they have been subsidizing those, whether it be people who are not or people in commercial properties. One example I'll give you, Steve, is the Star building that you used to work in for many years was valued at $4 million until this year when it sold. And it's now valued at over $13 million.
Wow.
If we were to roll that back and go back to as was requested, that means that burden would once again shift from the commercial property owner to the homeowner.
Teresa Galvin, what's the path forward as far as you're concerned?
Well, I think we need to, as Dan said, appeal to the state, see if there's some kind of consideration that we can get for this year to put things, you know, like I said, maybe not freeze, but just a small increase, 10 to 20%.
And if there's not?
We need to work on what we can do to move forward with the state and change some legislation.
Okay. We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our two members of the Jackson County Legislature, Teresa Galvin, the chairwoman, Dan Tarwater, the vice chair. Gail McCann-Beatty was here. She's the county director of assessment. Caleb Clifford, the chief of staff to county executive Frank White. Thank you all for a good conversation. Good luck navigating this.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Steve. Time. When we come back, we're going to talk about women and self-defense. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, a Republican and former U.S. congressman from Missouri shared why he's calling for President Trump's impeachment. You can hear that conversation and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, riots in Kansas prisons are costing taxpayers. We'll ask Kansas lawmakers what ideas they have for solving understaffing, overcrowding, and guaranteeing the security of inmates and officers. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, about 6 in 10 gun owners in the U.S. are male. Still, 1 in 5 women report that they own a gun, and the numbers are increasing. A majority of women also believe these days that owning a gun is more likely to protect someone from crime than to put their safety at risk. Why the shift, and why are some women opting to protect themselves through self-defense classes that don't involve firearms? That's what our next conversation will focus on. With us now, Corinne Mosier is a firearms instructor and competitive shooter from Overland Park. She's also the director of education at Center Fire Shooting Sports out in Olathe. Corinne, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Kathy Riley took a non-firearm self-defense class. Kathy, nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
So, Corinne, what's your sense here? Why are more women choosing handguns these days as a way to protect themselves?
I believe that women are becoming more aware of the danger in our society, and they are recognizing that firearms are the ultimate equalizer that is going to do more to dispel the disparity between men and women, size and strength, and give them the upper hand where they otherwise would be at a disadvantage.
A lot of women are scared, you're saying.
I'm saying that they're becoming aware. They're recognizing that there is danger and that it's real.
You know, who are these women who are signing up for firearms classes? Are they older women, college students, single moms? What are you seeing?
In my classes, I'm seeing a diverse array of women. I mean, we're talking about college students, like you said, mothers bringing their younger daughters, women who are living alone, women who are retired and women who are in the workplace working in areas that they feel that they need extra protection.
How big a shift is this? I mean, this idea that more women are opting to carry a gun as a means of protection, that seems to be a shift in our culture.
It is, and it's happening slowly but surely. And I think that it will only begin to grow as the industry markets more towards women and ranges are being built that are more welcoming to women and families.
At Center Fire Shooting Sports out in Olathe, no question you're seeing an increase in the number of women signing up for classes?
No question, and it's steadily growing.
Huh, okay. Well, Kathy, you opted to take a class not involving a gun for self-defense. Why?
Correct. Thank you, Steve. My friend actually owns Frontier Justice, and that business offers these classes. And the reason I chose to go is I have twins who are 21 years old. One's at Missouri, one's at Missouri State. So personally, I worry about their protection, especially my daughter who works at a bar and leaves at 2 a.m. sometimes. Mm. So I wanted to learn ways that we could be protected, and I'm not necessarily in favor of having a gun for her or myself. So this really focused on self-awareness of your surroundings and other tools like tactical pens that can be used and how to use mace, how to use pepper spray, different things that you can do to protect
sure.
yourself but not be carrying a gun.
Did you and your daughter take the class together?
That was the plan, but she had to work. So I went, but I taught her everything I learned.
You were teaching her everything you knew,
yes,
right?
Yes, and I bought her a pen, and I taught her how to use it, which it was taught by a retired police officer, and he was great about showing us how to do it so that you are in charge and confident.
What's your hesitancy to get training for a firearm?
I am not personally comfortable with the possibility of it being turned on me. And I guess you could say the same thing about those other types of weapons, but they're more like, for example, the tactical pen. You hold it up strongly when the attacker is several feet away and you say, "I'm armed," and they're less likely to come at you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid if I had a gun that I could shoot the wrong person. If I have my pen, I'm not going to accidentally stab somebody else. So that's one of the reasons.
The argument is you're taking a chance, though, because you don't have a kind of force with you that you might need at a moment like that.
At this point, I was just trying to learn how to be more protected in a way that is in my comfort zone. So
yeah.
That's where I am today.
Corinne, what would you say to Kathy about maybe coming out and taking a class at Center Fire Shooting Sports?
First of all, I would love to commend you for what you just said.
Thank you.
You're choosing a tool and an option that you're comfortable with right now. Awesome. That's the way it is. I would encourage anybody to choose multiple options for defense, not just a gun, not just a tac pen, I'm not armed right now with a firearm, but I do have a flashlight with me, and I have other methods like that. So I would highly recommend anybody to educate themselves on the safe, legal, ethical, moral use of any of these lethal or non-lethal weapons or tools, and to take that from a range of knowledgeable people so that you have the knowledge and skills to actually use it in the proper mm-hmm. way and have it ready and ready to use if you need to, if you have no other choice.
Yeah, Corinne, you're saying the key here, if I'm hearing you right, is whatever a person like Kathy is comfortable with, mm-hmm. that's really an important factor at any point.
At any point, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, your story is fascinating to me because you're a musician. Back in 2011, your husband urged you to take a shooting class. You had no interest. Then he took you out to the range, and you did pretty well. Is that what lit your interest, or was it more for protection, or what was your own story?
Well, at the time I took the concealed carry class, I really had no interest in concealed carrying. I was a musician. I went to UMKC's Conservatory of Music for violin performance. I had a private music studio with students, and I was content.
What happened to you?
What happened to me?
Yeah.
Oh, who knows? So little by little. So what happened is I took the concealed carry class, and in that class, the weight of the responsibility of being a gun owner and carrying a gun every day and potentially having to use it and the legalities surrounding it. And like you said, what if I shot the wrong yeah. person? What if I was wrong and I didn't need to shoot them? That is heavy stuff. And I decided you can't live on the fringes of this. You have to be all in or all out. You have to
Absolutely.
Devote yourself to it, or just please don't at all.
And what made you dive in head first? What made you choose one direction over the other?
You know, if I have to find a defining moment, it would be what happened to Kelsey Smith.
Remind us who Kelsey Smith was.
So Kelsey Smith was a young high school teenager that 3
yes.
miles from my home
yes.
was abducted in a Target parking lot
mm-hmm.
and was assaulted and killed and left in a field.
That scared you.
That affected me because it made me angry. It made me indignant. It made me hurt because this beautiful life was snuffed out. This person didn't have the right to do that, and yet he did. And so I thought, not me and not the people I love. So I began to make small changes. And I know that it seems drastic that I suddenly went into guns. It just happened to be that way. But the firearms training encompassed so much more than just pointing and shooting. It was the mindset that Kathy was talking about. It was situational awareness. It's de-escalation, conflict resolution, and carrying yourself with a new confidence that learning any skill, not just firearms, but any skill will give you. And it changes who you are. And so the small changes throughout the years, prompted by taking a concealed carry class, because, you know, I felt angry that there was evil in the world and I wanted to be able to protect myself from it.
Hmm. So the training got you over your concerns, you're saying?
I still have concerns. I still continue my training, but I feel like I am ready to take on whatever somebody throws at me.
Kathy, weigh in here.
Good points. One thing I wanted to mention is about women's right to freedom. If my daughter wants to run in the evening, why shouldn't she be able to? She shouldn't have to go into the gym and use a treadmill. If she wants to be out and be, you know, feel free to do that. So if she has some type of weapon, and in this form it's a tactical pen, or if mace, and now we know how to use that. If it's a windy day, you don't use it and sprays them right in your face. But now we have the confidence at this level that my daughter, who's 21, can have the freedom that I had when I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
Which is different now. There is more danger, and there are just more threats to our safety and our freedom.
Has she expressed any interest in getting firearms training, given the laws in, I get my states mixed up, but you can carry on college campuses in Missouri I believe?
Yeah. She has not. And just to give you a side note to this, when 4 years ago, when Megan and Jacob, my children, went off to college, he's at Missouri State, she's at MU, I tried to give them pepper spray, and they did not want it.
Hmm.
Since then, they have both seen, Jacob's seen muggings of young men.
Hmm.
Megan has, they've had lockdowns, and she readily took it, and she soaked in everything I told her and taught her. And my son is also much more, he's definitely interested, because they see the realities.
You know, Corinne, I'm just struck by, again, your own story. You described your interest in going and getting firearms training, but you've gone even further than that. You train and you are competing professionally now, I guess, in these different tournaments and doing pretty darn well.
Well, I began teaching in 2012 and competing in 2014. Competition is a way that you can develop your skill set, meet new people, travel, and, like I said, develop your own skill set. And I can take that back to my students, and it makes me a better instructor. I have also been able to teach firearms around the world. I've been to Malta, Italy, Sicily, and I'm very, very fortunate. So it's been little by little. I learned a skill. It gave me confidence. It gave me a passion. I wanted to share it. I went on and learned more. Same thing. And then I passed that on. So my love for giving women the choices, giving individuals, but particularly women, mm-hmm. That's where my passion is, giving them the options, giving them more choices, seeing their countenance change when they do something that they didn't think they were capable of doing before. I will never get over that, and I'll never stop doing what I do.
Yeah. You know, I'm struck also by this whole idea of how many women who come in to see you, Corinne, are visibly nervous taking this step of learning how to use a firearm.
So at the beginning of every ladies only class, I take however long it takes to go around the room and ask the women, what brought you here? What are you hoping most to get out of tonight? And so many sit there with their arms clenched in their laps and say, guns scare me. This is the first time I've been in a room with a gun, or I had a bad experience. Mm. And the first thing I say is, thank you for sharing that. I'm glad that you're nervous around guns, because it shows me that you have the right mindset towards firearms. You're the kind of person I want to spend time with on the range. You don't have to be scared once you have some knowledge. Now you can be cautious and competent.
Great.
Kathy?
I want to share an experience I had since taking this class. I went to Walmart really early in Lee's Summit a week after taking this class. And one of the things that the retired police officer talked about was not the weapons alone, but also your awareness of your surroundings. So my head was on a swivel. It was like 5:30 in the morning. There was a carjacking that took place. I got in the middle of it. I won't get into too many details because I don't think I should. Legally. Mm-hmm. But because of this class, I held my own and things turned out fine. The car was demolished. But the person, the victim is fine, and I'm fine. But I used some of those skills, and it was crazy how I felt like God delivered me to take that class and then kept me safe that next week.
I was going to say, how much confidence did you have as that moment unfolded in front of you? Did you have a thought in your mind that, hey, I can handle this thing?
I had a thought, and then I prayed, and then he said it's going to be okay.
Yeah, there you go. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're talking about self-defense, different ways women can go to deal with self-defense these days. Steve from Kansas City, Missouri, called in to recommend martial arts training, something we haven't talked about today. Mm-hmm. How else do you go ahead, Corinne, and make women comfortable with the idea of picking up a handgun, maybe for the first time, and actually firing it?
Well, first you have to commend them. If they come to class and they say, this makes me nervous, I'm scared, I don't think I can do this, you have to commend them for having those feelings, because it means that they're going to be careful and they're going to take a thoughtful approach in their learning process. And once you give them that small success of you're coming here for the right reasons and you belong here, once you give them that first success, it leads to the next. So as a gun person, sometimes we tend to want to give information like through a fire hose to people. We want to tell them everything at once.
I can imagine.
Because we're so excited, and we're excited to bring new people into what we do and to experience it with us. So I would recommend to women, come to the class, know that you belong, be choosy in which instructors you take from and which ranges that you you patron. Frontier Justice is an excellent place. I highly recommend you come to Center Fire Shooting Sports. And nowadays we have classes that are ladies only, not because women can't learn in co-ed situations, but because there is a demand for it. Mm-hmm. It makes women more comfortable. In the beginning of class, like I said, when I have everybody introduce themselves, that's 15 minutes of women networking and breaking the ice and finding women with similar stories to theirs, and suddenly they realize they have a network now.
Kathy, does it make more sense for you that women should teach women? There's an advantage there, or am I reaching too far?
I was just thinking kind of the opposite. I was just thinking of, I mean, I think that's great in certain ways, but at this class that I attended at Frontier Justice, it was a mix. There were older people, there was a woman with her teenage daughter, there was a middle-aged couple. So in this particular, I think in general, because society is more dangerous every day, we all need to be more aware. That diversity for that class was good. On the other hand, if I were to take that step, I would want to be in a women's only class to handle a gun, because I think the comfort level would be better. And maybe just your physicality. You know, do women need to hold it a little different? Like when I took golf lessons, they had special tips for women because we tend to pull our elbow back. You know, there's some things that are just biological.
Training women on firearms, there's an inherent advantage there, maybe for at least some women.
Well, Kathy nailed it right on the head. I mean, the physical differences. So when women come to class and they said, well, I got a revolver because I'm not strong enough to run the slide on a semi-automatic, I go, hey, I was there too. There was a time my husband took me to the range. I couldn't physically load my magazine, didn't know what to do when the gun, you know, went dry or jammed. I couldn't load it, couldn't rack it. All I did was point and shoot, and because I hit the target, I thought I was good. You know, there's so much more about it. And so when I can say, listen, I feel you, I get it. Yeah. Here's the technique that we're going to use that also works for bigger, stronger people, but it especially works for the smaller framed individual. And if I can do it, you can do it. And here's how we came to this technique. Mm-hmm. Now try it. And after the first or second attempt, they have it and they're just mind blown. Mm-hmm. That's really encouraging. So physical differences. You're right. Come to a female maybe to learn how to shoot. But when it comes to self-defense, there is nothing more powerful than a good man who can tell you how bad men think.
Yes.
And if you're going to go hands-on with the martial arts and stuff like that, you know, train with the men. Train with somebody who is going to might resemble somebody who might attack you.
Kathy, is there an age limit that you would recommend to our listeners that they should think about, an older woman who might be interested in pursuing something like this?
Absolutely, there's no age limit. Because just back to that idea of self-awareness, even if you don't arm yourself with a tool, the police officer gave tips on, you know, park under the light. Some of them seem, you know, it's not common sense.
Yeah.
But you're just going through this. park under the light, always have your head on a swivel, look people in the face. If you're walking towards me, Steve, and I look at your face and you're a bad man, we know you're a wonderful man, but if you're a bad man, you're not going to attack me because I've seen your face. I've looked in your eyes.
Just quickly, I'm running real short of time here. That pen you're describing, what does it do? And what's it called again?
It's called a tactical pen. You call it a tac pen for short.
What does it do?
Okay, so it's almost like a knife, but you hold it up like this. So mm-hmm.
You're putting your hand up like you're going to throw a football.
Yeah. Exactly. And you hold it with authority and mm-hmm. confidence. And if someone is looking at you like they're going to attack, you say, "Stop, I'm armed." And it can look like, it looks like a knife, but if you strike, it will cut your hand.
I'm going to have to leave our conversation. Okay. There's some great information here today. Corinne Mosier, again, Director of Education at Center Fire Shooting Sports in Olathe. Kathy Riley, taking a non-firearm self-defense class and recommending it. Thank you both very much. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about Kansas prisons. They're overcrowded and understaffed. What are lawmakers going to do here? I'm Steve Kraske. And you are up to date.